Chuck Spencer, Director of Government Affairs for Growmark.
Well, Chuck, we're reaching the end of 2011. We're going to take a look back on the political climate in Washington, D.C., particularly as it relates to agricultural and energy policy for this past year. Give us a little bit of an overview of what happened in 2011.
Well, it has been a year that has challenged many in the area of energy policy, both from the standpoint of price fluctuation, but then also supply and sourcing opportunities. And what I mean by that is where we've had the challenges of offshore drilling, and then also the continuation of permits for offshore drilling. Domestic source supply is really then what that comes back to, doesn't it? Is will we as a country choose to develop our natural resource base, including petroleum and energy products, or will we continue to be reliant or even growingly reliant on other nations and their production? I think that what we're seeing is certainly with the economy and the turndown we've had domestically, our energy demand cycle has been flat to slightly decreasing for this past immediate time frame, but the rest of the world has energy needs have been increasing. And we've also seen for the first time most recently gasoline beginning to be exported from the United States because of our refining capacity and demand overseas. At the same time, we've had wonderful natural gas discoveries in the shales of the East Coast, and then you watch the Dakotas producing natural gas as well as energy products through oil. And surplus budgets within the states in which those discoveries are made, particularly in the plains. So you see a lot of messages coming our way, and I think in agriculture, particularly when it comes to energy, we want reliable, we want economically competitive energy sources. As a country, I think what we are looking for is security, energy security, and that's going to come from the mix of both domestic production, of course sourcing it through allies of international production, and I think we're going to see a continuation of expansion of our relationship with our friends in Canada, of which we import over 45% of our oil from at this point in time.
And, of course, when we talk about domestic energy, one of the things that comes to mind, of course, is ethanol and biodiesel. And ethanol has continued to be attacked by critics. But the ethanol industry came around this year and said, okay, we're fine. You know, go ahead and get rid of the ethanol blender's tax credit. They were even willing to let it go early, which didn't happen. But at any rate, it is set to expire at the end of this year. What impact do you think that will have on the domestic ethanol industry?
I think the domestic ethanol industry has been preparing for this moment for some time, but most particularly this past year. They recognized that political interests were such that it would be unlikely for an extension of the full tax credit when it expires December 31st of this year. I think in that planning process, working to keep their plants operating at peak efficiency, understanding the management of both their inputs and then the value of their outputs has been critical for the continued successful operation of biofuels. You know, Cindy, one of the things that we see, and we talked about the global demand for energy, is that the energy table is rather large, and there's plenty of chairs at the table for all sources, whether it's domestic petroleum, foreign petroleum, but particularly biofuels, renewable fuels of a vast type, would all be welcome toward the energy table. We're going to see our fuel sources continue to diversify, and that diversity is going to come strength. And I think what we see as far as production capacity in this country and the ability for agriculture to meet these demands, I think this is both a positive economic picture we've experienced in agriculture, but we're up to the challenge for future demand as well. I think we're all looking forward to more corn acres being planted, more soybean acres planted. Farmers are responding to market signals, which have been some of the most transparent we've had in recent time, because the market is clearly sending signal demand for food products, renewable products, fiber products, and, of course, proteins from our livestock industry all coming into play here within the next year. So we're hopeful that 2012 turns into a very productive year and that we've made the proper adjustments for life without the tax credit for ethanol and biodiesel.
Well, and you made a good point as far as diversity of energy sources is concerned, because a lot of times when ethanol in particular gets attacked, you know, they say, well, the ethanol can only meet X percentage of our energy needs. And the ethanol industry is quick to point out, no, we don't expect every vehicle to be running on ethanol. And as you said, we've got a diverse assortment of energy sources that we can take advantage of here domestically. But one of the things that when we talk about the blender's tax credit going away, a lot of the ethanol critics in particular, or domestic biofuels critics, are going after now the renewable fuel standard, which is requiring that a certain percentage of our particularly transportation fuels be renewable. How important is the RFS to both the ethanol and biodiesel industries?
I think the renewable fuel standard is a cornerstone of domestic renewable fuel policy, that it is very important to see that that is an emphasis area and a policy decision that we in this country have chosen to make to begin the process of diversifying domestic fuel production. We know that there's finite sources of petroleum fuels. We're continuing to become more effective and efficient at developing them, so they go farther, they last longer, and those are all positive trends. I think the same can be said for domestic renewable fuel production. Ethanol, biodiesel, our plants, our process continue to gain economic and production efficiencies. I can't tell you how many times I still answer the question about the net BTU output. I mean, we're up to 2.8 to 2.9 gallons of ethanol produced in corn ethanol production. Of course, cellulosic ethanol production still coming on board. And as we know, biodiesel is produced through either types of cropping oils, which soybean oil is a favorite, also animal fats and fat products in which you can remove the glycerin and are left with the esters. There are value in both of these fuel sources for the high-quality fuel they provide, the octane in ethanol and cetane in biodiesel, and the lubricity of biodiesel. All are components to fuels that are very complementary, not only to the operations of the engines and the equipment that they're in, but also to the emissions out the tailpipes for each of their respective categories. And I think that's something that we will see continue to be more in demand in the future. As automobile power plants and their engines continue to get smaller in size, their output remains the same as far as horsepower and what we demand in our performance of our vehicles. That means there's going to be more demand placed on those smaller engines, and that's where the fuel of ethanol providing octane and some very desirable qualities for performance will be more desirable and come into increasing play. I think that's important. I think also when it comes to renewable fuel standard, considering some of the fuel processes as advanced biofuels, recognizing that biodiesel is an advanced biofuel, and then ethanol has qualities that could certainly become one as well, where it can be considered an advanced biofuel here in the next few years. I think a strong case can be made. So we have some continued promise here, I think, as far as renewable fuels, our ability to produce, and what that means to local economies across the country.
Well, now, we've got a farm bill set to expire next year. We're hoping that the Super Committee, if they had done their job, we could have had a farm bill incorporated at that, but that didn't happen. We're looking at the possibility of having to now write a farm bill in an election year with a growing federal deficit. How do you think that might play out, and what do you expect to see possibly as an energy title in a new farm bill?
Yeah, there's a number of questions there in that overview, and you're right. And taking them one by one, the Super Committee did find the agriculture community stepped up to the plate, hammered out an agreement between all the different commodity associations, and as you had pointed out, we're in agreement to submit a farm bill within the structure of the Super Committee and have it passed. They were clear on their agreement to $23 billion over a 10-year period reduction in farm program spending. And some of that spending did come from nutrition titles and conservation, but there was a major focus, as always, on the commodity title. The 15 titles of the farm bill, there's a lot of discussion right now. I think that you see from the committee chairman, Stabenow and Lucas, that they feel as though they had an agreement, and it's, if they're going to go through regular order now, which most people are suggesting and calling for, but that regular order, the discussion, where do you begin? Do you start over? Do you begin where everybody agreed, and then do you move forward? I think you're going to find people over the next few weeks in this formative stage of how they're going to do this in 2012 with the Farm Bill. I think you're going to see them look toward the agreement that was worked out in the Super Committee as the distinct groundwork, if not the framework, for what they'll be discussing throughout 2012. I think, too, Cindy, it's important to note that while the Farm Bill will expire in 2012, it either needs to be extended or they'll have to come to agreement here in 12 and pass it, or the 1949 Farm Bill goes into play, which is dealing with parity prices. And that, of course, would certainly be a budget buster if you're looking at trying to reduce spending, because spending levels would distinctly go up. I think that is a motivation for why farm policy will be looked at in 12 and some action taken, either an extension or the passage. And I think that what we know is that there's a number of people, both outside of the farm interests, who feel as though farm program spending should be pared back even further. And I think I remind us all that farm program, and particularly the commodities title itself that seems to get the lion's share of discussion out of the 15 titles, one title gets 90% of the conversation. That commodity title is only 0.2% of the total federal budget, and it's provided as a safety net and a way to manage risk is how we've now changed the title from 2008, and you'll notice that 90% of the groups offering proposals to the Super Committee asked for a revenue-based, risk management-based safety net, and I think all of us in business understand how we need to manage risk.
Now, Chuck, really, why is GrowMark so involved on the policy level and the legislative level? Because you really, maybe people are not well as aware that they think of GrowMark as a co-op, and that's just it. But you're really involved on the legislative level on issues that will impact farmers and ranchers.
Yes, we are, and we are involved with a number of trade associations and then also in direct representation of GrowMark as an agricultural cooperative. And I think we know that in public policy, in local, state, and federal levels of government, you have people trying to develop policies and regulations, and they don't always have the actual experience of what the impact could be to agriculture at the farm level, but particularly what it may mean for a cooperative. And how cooperatives work. That's where our responsibility comes in. We have professionals in energy, agronomy, grain origination and movement. We have professionals in tax perspectives as well, and financial perspectives. And we can help these policymakers make decisions that are both workable, achievable, and will help the overall economy. And I think that while we at times express frustration with policymakers and maybe some of the decisions we hear, what I offer to us is what have we done to provide input into that decision-making process to have an outcome that is agreeable or better? And that's what we ask ourselves every day in government affairs and GrowMark. What policies are being proposed? What regulations could impact cooperatives? Who do we need to talk to and contact and provide the input necessary to explain to them how our operations are functioning and what they're proposing either will enhance and help or could detract and be a detriment to both the operation and the local economy? Most of the time we find people are very willing to not only take the input but then make adjustments because to something that may be harmful either to economies or to systems of operations. They want to make sure that business thrives and survives while being responsible in a regulated community. And I think that's what our objective is here in government affairs, is being a responsible part of that policy development system, both in lawmaking as well as regulation making as well.
Well, it's good to know that agriculture and the cooperative system itself has another voice in Washington, D.C. and at the state level as well. Thank you very much, Chuck Spencer, Director of Government Affairs for GrowMark this week. I'm Cindy Zimmerman.